We acted because the consequences of AIG failing would have been catastrophic for our economy and for American families and businesses.
Hello and welcome to NPR's Planet Money. I'm David Cheech Kestenbaum.
And I'm Alex Chong Bloomberg. Today is Wednesday, January 27th. That was Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner. You heard at the top of this podcast, as you've heard at the top of many podcasts. He was testifying before Congress about the bailout of AIG. Our topic today, David, is tied to our economic indicator. The indicator is $14 billion.
And that is one estimate for the size of California's largest cash crop.
Oranges?
Nope.
Organic milk?
No. Marijuana.
Thought that number seemed high.
I'd say that is just one estimate. It comes from a report in the Bulletin for Cannabis Reform.
Know it well.
But
it's my favorite bulletin. Sorry. It's my favorite cannabis-related bulletin.
I'm just trying to make the point that pot is a significant industry. I mean, I don't know what part of GDP it is, all right? But look, I read an actual news story by a real reporter today about how the city of Los Angeles is voting to shut down a lot of the stores selling medical marijuana. And the story said there were about 1,000 stores selling pot just in Los Angeles.
Now, David, I know that you've had marijuana as one of your Google alerts for a long time now, and I'm not going to ask questions about that. But you actually did get into this. There's a legitimate economic reason that you're interested in the story recently.
You know, I read the story about how the governor of New Jersey this month signed into law a medical marijuana bill, and New Jersey is like the 14th state to pass one. And it mentioned something about how the state was going to help set the price. And I just started thinking, like, what happens to the price of drugs that are illegal when they become legal? Like, do they go up? Do they go down? And I found someone who knows about these things. He's an economist, and he even works at a place you've heard of.
Jeffrey Miron, senior lecturer in the Department of Economics at Harvard University.
And the paper we're going to talk about, it was actually published in a real journal.
Yeah, I was happy. I was very happy about that.
Yeah. It's in the Review of Economics and Statistics. Yeah.
Wow. So you've got a Harvard researcher in a peer-reviewed journal talking about the price of marijuana.
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome.
the question is really like, how much would marijuana cost if it got totally legalized? Because there's this argument out there that if you legalize drugs, they will get really cheap. I mean, for marijuana, right? It's just a stupid plant. You know, how much can it cost to grow a plant, right? It should be like lettuce or something.
Right. And actually, it doesn't matter which side of the legalization debate you are on. Both sides make this argument that if you legalize drugs, they will get cheaper. And it makes some sense. Say you're a drug dealer sneaking cocaine into Miami. You need fast boats. You need maybe a helicopter. You need guns, thugs, money for bribes. And all that, of course, adds up. Plus, if you have enough guns, maybe you have a monopoly and you can jack up the price even more.
Yeah, it totally makes sense, right? And there are numbers out there saying that if you make drugs like heroin or cocaine or pot legal, the price will plunge. It'll go way down. And some people say it'll go down like, you know, a factor of 100 or 1,000.
Wow. So if it costs, I don't know,
$1,000 an ounce, I have no idea, it would cost a dollar an ounce or something. Yeah, way on sale. Everything is on sale. So both sides make this argument. And the people who want to keep pot illegal say, you know, it's going to get cheaper, and that's bad because more people will end up using it if it's cheaper.
And of course, the people who want to legalize pot say, dude, exactly. Make it cheaper. I can do more drugs.
Yeah, it's making me bankrupt, right?
Right, exactly. Right.
So Jeffrey Miron, he actually thought these claims, they were wrong. He says there's no way making drugs legal will bring the prices down by, you know, 1,000 times. And so how does he know? He decided to compare the markups for marijuana, cocaine, and heroin with other stuff.
I went and got data for a bunch of legal products like coffee, chocolate, potato chips, tobacco, a number of things that are produced as an agricultural product on a farm. You can get the farm gate price, the price of the raw materials as they leave the farm.
Right.
And we can compare it to the retail price at which it's sold in stores to consumers.
And these are all legal? Potato chips, totally legal?
These are all legal.
Okay. Well, I'm looking at your paper here. Actually, you write that there's an – if I go buy a candy bar, milk chocolate at the corner store, it's an 88 times markup or 88%?
88 times.
88 times, so 8,800%?
That's right. But of course, think about all the time and effort it would take you to actually sort of live in a climate that will support the cultivation of cocoa beans and to go through all the steps and – culturing them and curing them so that they can be made into chocolate.
Yeah, whatever, but 88? That's a huge markup.
We're not talking double, 88 times.
I agree, but that's why I looked at lots and lots of different products, because if you there are other things that might be going on that make it a little messy. So I wanted to see if it were true generally that we take goods that start as a net life as an agricultural product from some farm and they end up as some highly processed, refined consumer product. We see these big changes, these big markups, and we found very consistently that you did. Now, there's, as you know, there's a big range. You know, sometimes it was 50, sometimes it was 200, a few cases it was 400 or 500. So that suggests that just because we see that big markup for coca or heroin, it doesn't prove that price would fall by 1,000 to 1.
I mean, when you study economics, you know, one of the things you learn is that in a competitive market, no one's supposed to be making a lot of money, and pretty quickly the price should be driven down to, you know, close to the minimum, right? But there's still this huge markup for these products. Why is that? What are the things that go into that?
Well, there's lots of different steps that go into getting it from the farm gate to getting it to the retail. There's the transportation cost, there are insurance costs, there's distribution cost of having a lot of stores or middlemen who are willing to take your product and then distribute it out to the retail stores. There's advertising in the cases of most of these products. And there are all sorts of other things that you and I probably don't even really think about because we're not in the business of actually making these goods, but all sorts of little things that add to the cost.
So suppose we compare illegal drugs to, you know, potato chips, coffee, chocolate. How does the markup compare? You've just told me that it actually is a large markup for ordinary things. How does that compare to the markup for illegal drugs?
So we find that the markup for illegal drugs indeed seems to be higher, okay, significantly higher than those for legal products. But if you use the legal products as a benchmark, I think you'd come to the conclusion that cocaine roughly is probably 2 to 5 times more expensive now than it would be in a legal market. Heroin, you know, even much more. It may be 15 to 20 times more expensive than it would be in a legal market. So the general conclusion that prices would drop substantially is correct. My claim is mainly that it has been way overstated by how much it would drop.
Alex, you know what I love about this? It gets at that question of, like, why anything costs what it costs. You know, when you look at something in the store, like, what is in that price tag? I have to say I'm still surprised that the markup for illegal drugs isn't worse, though.
Yeah, I mean, imagine, like, let's say chocolate chip cookies. Imagine they were illegal and you had to get them in from Canada and you had to sneak them across the border and you had to create a false bottom in some truck and fill it with fake products to throw off the customs inspectors. And then you had to trust whoever drives that truck isn't going to disappear with all your cookies. I mean,
I know. The cookies would be very, very expensive.
A lot of overhead.
Yeah, a lot of overhead. So I mean, I asked Jeffrey Myron about that and he said, well, you know, there are a couple of things going on. One is that, you know, the drug enforcement agents may not be as good as you think they are at making things hard for the drug dealers.
The enforcement authorities may not be very effective at trying to drive up the cost. You know, the enforcement authorities are government officials who have their hearts in the right place, and yet their livelihoods are not necessarily dependent on being successful. Okay? If, in fact, the prices don't really get driven up that much, they don't necessarily lose their jobs. It's not their businesses that they're attending. So, you know, I'm a libertarian. I tend not to think of government as being especially competent at things that it does, and this may be one more example of that. So they just are not very adept. And the traffickers have a strong incentive to be cleverer than the law enforcement, and so they think of clever ways. If the police interdict one way of getting stuff into the country, they land routes, then the traffickers find sea routes or air routes and things like that. So I think that's the key reason. The second is that there's just zillions of people out there in the country who are looking to make a profit. If there were really significant profits, then we would see people move into that industry to try to compete away those profits. And that's true in an underground market as much as in an above ground market.
In other words, if I were overcharging for my heroin in Baltimore, there's probably going to be some competition and someone's going to try and undercut my price a bit and steal my
customers. That's right. People are going to go up to Philadelphia where it's a little cheaper and bring it back down and arbitrage away that excessive price that maybe is occurring in Baltimore.
I saw that on the wire.
Point in time. Absolutely. What a great show.
There's another component that if I'm bringing in heroin and cocaine illegally, I don't have to pay taxes. So I'm saving money that way?
Another potentially significant reason, and one I sort of document in my own research, is that if you're a legal supplier, then you are likely going to comply with a whole set of cost-increasing policies, taxes, laws against using child labor, environmental regulation, OSHA regulation, whole bunch of things. If you're a black market supplier, you're already evading the law. You're already hiding your activities from the police, so you're not going to bother to comply with all those things. So it's a very simple example. There's tons of underage labor that's utilized in the illegal drug industry. Okay? If you run a McDonald's, you don't do that because you'd get caught and you'd pay a fine for using underage labor. But if you're a cocaine trafficker, you might as well use the cheapest labor you can get, and that might mean 10 or 12-year-olds.
I see. So that's another reason why black market prices might not be as high as you think, because they're saving money in all these other ways.
They're saving money by not paying taxes and complying with all sorts of regulations.
I love – well, first of all, I love how economists find a way to get words like arbitrage into any conversation. But I also love how like actually there's all these factors at work that actually make illegal drugs cheaper than legal drugs.
The paper's pretty great. I mean, it's just interesting to see this intersection of these two topics, you know, because it's an economic paper, but in the middle of it, he lists the steps you need to make cocaine to kind of add up the pieces. One, raw coca leaves are picked by hand, dried in sun, and marketed. Two, dried coca leaves are mashed with water and sulfuric acid. You
know, right.
Anyway, he says that this, you know, what he thinks is false argument about how much prices would drop, it's made by both sides of the legalization debate. But there is this other economic argument, and it's just made by one side, and he says it's also wrong. It's an argument the pro-legalization side makes, the side that wants to make marijuana and drugs legal. And the argument is, hey, legalize pot because it will make the government money. You're going to save all this money on law enforcement and put a tax on it, you know. And actually, there's a bill in California right now that would legalize pot and tax it.
The argument, you know, has a sort of good history because that's one of the main arguments made for repealing prohibition in the 1930s, partially because U.S. didn't have much experience with income taxes at that point. The rates were very low. So if you're going to tax something, there was wanted to go back to taxing alcohol.
Really? It was financial? I didn't know that.
That was one, that and the crime. Those were the two arguments that people made.
I see. Okay,
and the Great Depression.
It wasn't that this is crazy. It's just alcohol. People like to drink. It's all right.
Well, people have been making those arguments all along. But what changed was the crime rate soared, you know, all the Al Capone stuff. The Great Depression seemed to created, they thought, a need to raise more taxes. Of course, that's backwards from the standard Keynesian view. But at the time, they thought that raising taxes and balancing the budget was a good idea. Uh-huh. And one of the arguments that had been made for alcohol prohibition was it would guarantee prosperity. And so this big downturn that was pretty obvious by 31, 32, okay, made it seem unlikely that prohibition was in fact guaranteeing prosperity.
Because it would end addiction and
It would prevent would end workplace accidents. It would end people coming to jobs, okay, under the influence of alcohol or going out at lunch and drinking a lot of beer and coming back and not being productive in the workplace.
That was one of the big arguments made
for alcohol prohibition.
So one of the big arguments made for prohibition was economic, was that we'll get an economic boost from this. It'll save lives. And then one of the arguments made for getting rid of prohibition was also economic, which is that, hey, this is going on. It's expensive to try and stop it from happening. And we could tax it.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Had you heard those arguments?
No, I didn't. No.
So the claim is that now is that legalizing pot in California and taxing it will raise $1.3 billion, which the government of California desperately needs. You know, we're constantly hearing about the budget crisis there. But Myron says when he does the math, he gets a much smaller number than $1.3 billion.
But my numbers are like an order of magnitude smaller.
In fact, 10 times smaller?
Well, yeah, one-tenth. Yeah. Than the numbers these guys come up with. And it makes me very nervous because, one, I just think it's going to be bad to look as though they sold the public a bill of goods, to claim it's going to raise $1 billion and, in fact, raises $100 million. Now, $100 million isn't nothing, but compared to the size of the California budget deficit, rounding error. Right. It's pretty much nothing. My estimate for the whole U.S., adding together federal and state is only about $75 billion. And that's from full legalization of the, you know, every single drug. So again, $75 billion compared to our budget deficits, you know, maybe it's not irrelevant, but it's pretty small.
Why is their number 10 times larger than yours? Why do they say it'll save in California, it'll raise $1 billion in California, and you say only $100 million?
In essence, their estimate of the size of the industry is much, much bigger than mine. So I relied on one particular source for the size of the industry, and I relied on it for two reasons. First is that it's a government source. It's a study commissioned by the ONDCP, Drugs Czar's office. And so that made it sort of relatively immune to criticism from the prohibitionists. They can't say, oh, you used our number. How dare you use our number? We know our numbers are garbage. You know, that would. But secondly, the methodology seemed pretty reasonable to me. And it implies an industry that's, you know, maybe somewhat smaller than the tobacco or alcohol industries, but roughly in that ballpark. And that seems imaginable to me. The numbers that some of these other guys have come up with imply that the legalized marijuana industry would be, you know, 2, 5, 10 times the size of the current alcohol tobacco industry in the U.S. It just, to me, doesn't pass a sniff test.
Alex, I should point out that Jeff Myron, by the way, he is in favor of legalizing drugs. He said he's a libertarian, but he thinks that because he thinks people should be able to do what they want as long as they're not hurting other people. But he says, as an economist, like, these numbers just bug him. The numbers being thrown around really bug him. They seem wrong to him, so he feels the need to set the record straight. He says, you can argue for legalizing marijuana, but don't say it's going to make us a lot of money.
Right, and it's fairly compelling if they're arguing that the size of the marijuana industry is 10 times larger or 5 times larger than all alcohol. That seems pretty fishy to me. Dave, I have just one more question, though.
Oh, yeah. Don't worry. I asked it. What's your favorite drug?
My favorite drug is Sapphire Gin. I don't touch any of the other drugs. I mean, I, you know, did the standard youthful experimentation, but
didn't
one
inhale.
Just didn't appeal. No, I did inhale, but I didn't actually enjoy the high. I enjoyed I think it's partially experience. You know, I know how to titrate how much alcohol I consume. I know exactly when I feel just, you know, mildly relaxed, and that's great. And so marijuana just didn't make – I tell you a funny story. It didn't make me – it made me feel a way I didn't know how to control or wasn't used to or didn't know what to do with. So I was at this drug policy conference. There was a bunch of academics, and one guy at the table for dinner was the head of a treatment center in New York City, a Phoenix House, a very famous treatment center. And everybody basically had the same story. Yeah, in college I tried a few times, but I didn't really like it, but I'd much rather have a drink. And it got to this guy who was the treatment guy, and he said, yeah, you guys all fit the standard pattern. He says, you're all these type A academics. You want to be in control of everything. Type A's don't like marijuana so much. What you guys really need is heroin. Because when you take heroin, you feel like nothing is a problem. You can handle anything. And so ever since he said that, I've been intrigued. And the day it became legal, I would try it. But I don't do any of that stuff now.
Alex, you want to know what my favorite drug is?
What's your favorite drug?
Baby aspirin.
I like a multivitamin. I guess that does it for us today. Let us know what you, all of you listeners out there, pay for your marijuana in those legal clinics, of course. And if you know, tell us how it compares to the street price where you are. Send us all of that to totally anonymous, planetmoney@npr.org. I'm Alex Bloomberg.
And I'm David Kestenbaum. Thank you for listening.